From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for being with us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. For the third week in a row, we'll begin this podcast with a powerful personal story. We've been fortunate to hear many of these on the program recently, and this one is a story that can bring us some perspective.
Yeah, Bashir Qayyum was an interpreter for the U.S. military in his native Afghanistan. After serving, he, his wife, and his almost one-year-old daughter applied for special immigrant visas to the United States because they faced retaliation from the Taliban. In many cases, it can take years for visas to be approved. But Bashir and his infant daughter were facing health challenges that required immediate care. With the help of a local nonprofit in Rochester called No One Left Behind, they were able to expedite the process, and the family arrived in Rochester in January.
In this clip, you'll hear Bashir talk about how his life would have been different or how it could have been cut short if he didn't get that visa. It's a compelling conversation about war, sacrifice, and finding peace in the U.S.
If I didn't get the visa, like, let me tell you one thing. Today I saw a Facebook page about the SIV Afghan family, and there was like one guy killed because his visa was denied, and he was the interpreter, and he killed. And maybe Miss Ellen saw that in that page.
A retribution so, killing, Ellen? Is that...
Yes. I mean, the Taliban know who works for us. It's not a secret.
Like, even in my state, Kunduz, that's in north, there's a still Taliban. I cannot go there. If they can catch me, and they will slice me. So the most important thing is my life, and my wife, and my child life. You know, I was only worried about my life and my family life. So we are here. I'm safe. I'm very happy now because the country which we are living, we have a lot of stress. So, yeah, I'm worried about my health, but the first worry is my life.
So you're talking about not fearing the Taliban, then also the medical problems that you and your daughter...
No, we are there's a lot of fear of Taliban. We cannot, like, go to our...
Sure. Yeah. Do you feel like Ellen does, that there is not a lot of hope that there will be peace, that there will be some sort of brokered agreement? I mean, do you have any hope that your home country will change?
Yeah, everyone has a hope, by the way, because the world is going on hope. So I have a hope, so one day my country will be fine.
Do you believe it?
Yeah, I believe that. One day, maybe, I don't know when, but maybe I will not alive, but one day we will definitely have a peace with the help of U.S. government.
Yeah, I mean, I think about how much would have to change. When my son was in kindergarten, there was an Afghan refugee child in class with him, and he said, you know, maybe someday we'll all go to Afghanistan together. And it was difficult for me to have to tell my five-year-old at the time that may not be possible for a long time.
No, it's not possible for the long time, as you said.
In our lifetimes, do you think?
Maybe or maybe not, both. I'm considering that because everywhere, if you go to any state, there is like a fear of Talibans. Like, I can go to my state. Like, there is a few other states in my side. We cannot go there. Like by car, you cannot take your car and whatever. You should have your beard long. If they catch you and they know, so you're working with the interpreter, so you're gone.
What do you think the Taliban wants? What motivates them?
They're the enemy of our countries, and I don't know whom to with them. But the thing they are doing, that's not in our religion as well. Like, they're thinking they are a Muslim, but they are not, by the way, because they are killing Muslims. That is not a good idea. Even our religious reject that.
So you think that they're motivated by what they think is
Islam?
Yeah,
they have the ideology, a very bad ideology, so they're...
What do you want to do here in Rochester, Bashir? What are your goals for your family and yourself?
My goals, now I'm going to Oasis for a short-term course. And then I have my long goal, so I love medical department. So I'm going to have a heart specialist degree. So because my daughter has PFO, the heart hole, so I thought I will go to medical department and have my heart specialist degree.
So, okay. Yeah, that sounds, I think it sounds outstanding. Yeah. And you talk about your daughter. She's doing well now.
Yeah, she's very active. She gained weight, and she's very sweet and very cute.
Do you feel like as her dad, learning about her heart and the hole in her heart, have you had a lot to learn about what, you know, I guess when we have medical conditions or our children do, we have to sort of become experts.
Yeah,
in
you're
that.
Right.
Have you,
you're right.
Has that happened for you?
Oh, yeah, even for me, for myself, because I'm a CML patient. I know about my sickness. Mm-hmm. I know about my daughter's sickness. Yep. So I'm usually going to meet a doctor with my daughter because I have to know about that because my wife can't speak English that much.
Mm-hmm. What has your experience been here in Rochester? How has it been for you in 2 months?
Oh, the people are very cooperative. And the peace, which I saw here, we don't have back in our country. Like, we are so peaceful here. Like, when I sleep in my apartment, so I feel peace. Like, back in our country, when we are sleeping, so we always scared. Like, we have a fear in our heart. So maybe someone come in our home, and they will kill us, or they will do whatever they do.
Wow. So you're, for the first time in your life, you're going to bed at night not scared.
Yeah. So that was a very nice experience of me. And I love, you know, back in my country, I can't sleep. You know, I always on my lights. I can't sleep without light. But here, off all light, please.
Do you feel that same way when you're traveling around Rochester, that you don't have to be fearful?
No, nothing. I'm very happy, by the way. Always dancing, even in the transit center when I'm here, I'm listening to the music.
I wish our listeners could see him. He's literally dancing.
Even we cannot do that back in our country. Like, and you can dance. Oh, that's awful.
That's right. The Taliban forbids dancing.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're not allowed to dance.
No. That's that. So I enjoy, by the way, I enjoy every moment of my life now.
Are you a good dancer?
Oh, yeah. I love it. I love Michael Jackson. Moonwalk.
Oh, yeah. Bashir, is your wife happy here?
Yeah, she's very happy. Like, we have, our culture is different. Like, when we were back in our country, so my all family, they were like my brother and sister, they are yelling on my wife. And even, I cannot take my wife outside for the lunch or for the dinner. We are not allowed, like. Mm-hmm. But now she's very much happy. She's roaming around. She's going to grocery shopping. And she's very happy. And I'm happy too.
Next, hundreds of people in Rochester gathered to show solidarity for the Muslim community last weekend following the mass shooting at two mosques in New Zealand. We sat down with local Muslims to discuss how to curb Islamophobia and how to support people of the Islamic faith.
In this clip, you'll hear from two local Muslims, Alma Omar Hadzik and Sarir Fazali. Here's Sarir first.
It's something that, you know, I think about often because my 7-year-old was watching the news yesterday and says to me, "Daddy, what bad thing happened?" And there wasn't even volume on the news at that time. They were just the pictures, and she read something. I have still faith in human nature. In my experience before I was in the leadership at the Islamic Center, during and even after, I have tremendous faith in people being able to take a step back, have a conversation, and then come to a decision. A week ago, I was a part of a conference at Nazareth College, and my session was on Islamophobia. And I had these kids from all across Western New York, all across Rochester, excuse me, all across the county, different schools, suburbs, urban, a little bit more rural. And I told them, I said, "Tell me how bad I am so that I can give you an example of why I'm not, or at least I can try to show you why that's the wrong opinion or attitude." I gave them some examples of some stuff I had been through in traveling and how I was treated. And they all had the same thing. They said, "Sir, we don't think you're bad at all. We think you may be a little misunderstood. And we think that, you know, people are making efforts to try to clear up that misunderstanding." But I had the most diverse group of kids from across the county and a little bit beyond. And I thought about it. I said, this is one heck of a start. I may not be able to get every egg before it cracks, but I'm going to get a few. And those are the ones that are going to lead the next generation. If it's not their parents, it's them. If it's not them, it might be their kids, because it's the exposure that they're getting to people of different faiths from different countries, that is going to help to solve this problem. You know, like I said, we all bring a lot of baggage when we come from overseas. I don't like somebody from this country, they don't like me or whatever. We come here, all of a sudden, it's a different game. We hear about a lot of stuff, and then when we see it opposite in practice, we realize, or we should realize, it's very hard not to see how the fabric of these communications and discussions in America take place without realizing that whatever baggage we may have had put into us at home or abroad, it doesn't really have any weight.
Alma, what can we do to kind of stop those seeds from growing?
Well, I have to say that yesterday before I went to the mosque for the because I knew this event was happening in support of the Muslims, I actually sat all three of my children and I had a talk with them. I often describe myself as a full-time volunteer. I am really involved in the community. I try to fight poverty, racism, Islamophobia, whatever it is, and I hope that I act in ways that actually shows my kids that, you know, any kind of hate is not okay. But I actually made it a point yesterday to sit them down in front of me and tell them it's not okay not to like anyone for whatever reason it is. And in this house, we teach love. And in this house, you know, we teach understanding, and in this house, we teach actually communication. It was extremely powerful for me yesterday when I was standing in the hallway of the Islamic Center, surrounded by all kinds of different people, to actually see a young Mormon girl who is one of my daughter's best friends actually come out of the crowd to hug me. And I told my daughter when I got home, I really am glad that you're choosing your friends wisely. And I hope that by my daughter being in the community and actually being exposed, and the community being exposed to my daughter and someone like you know, who wears a hijab, who is proudly Muslim American, that she is changing some narratives and maybe she's forcing people to see, okay, well, these people are normal just like we are.
We'll end the week with a conversation about photojournalism in the current media landscape. RIT photojournalism graduates have been recognized with 13 Pulitzer Prizes over the last decade or so. We had the opportunity to meet a few of the winners and finalists this week when they were back in town to meet with current RIT students.
In this clip, you'll hear David Carson, a 2015 Pulitzer Prize winner in breaking news photography, for his coverage of events in Ferguson, Missouri, after the death of Michael Brown. But first, here's Paula Braunstein, a 2011 Pulitzer Prize finalist in breaking news photography. She's discussing her work covering the war in Afghanistan and historic floods in Pakistan and the toll that that work took on her.
Now we're in our 17th year. Nobody can really understand how we got there, you know, America's longest war, and why. And all the troops that have been killed, maimed, you know, who have really... I mean, and I have to say, I have a tremendous empathy for the translators that worked for the military. Mm-hmm. I know what they did personally, and the translators that worked for us, the media, they took a lot of risks. Yes, it was good money for them at the time, but then if the Taliban are, you know, causing them tremendous security issues and they're trying to leave the country, I can't even imagine how long it took this particular man that you just spoke with mm-hmm. yesterday, how many years it took him to get here, how long he was waiting for that U.S. visa. It's been tough for these guys, and I know it. And I felt, you know, so I have a lot of empathy for them, the ones that make it. And of course, under the Trump administration, it's even more difficult for them to get their special visas to this country.
What are some of the images that not only will we find in your book, but that maybe stay in your mind above others that help tell a story of Afghanistan?
Well, a lot of what I did over the years was a number. I did a lot of feature stories, you know, so I really was trying to show not just the news images. I mean, I did cover elections. I covered the aftermath of suicide bombings. Mm-hmm. I mean, I covered some really horrific stuff, did extensive stories on the war wounded. And I think it was the war wounded, for me, in other words, the civilian casualties, that impacted me the most, because I felt like they are off the news within 24 hours. So let's say another bombing happens in Kabul. That is in the news for a very short period of time, and then it's gone. But those families are impacted, the loved ones that are lost. You know, if a young woman becomes an amputee, her life is very, very difficult, if not over, because she maybe cannot produce children. You know, it goes on and on, and like, we don't have time to get into that. But for me, it was highlighting those people, those silent victims, that was very important to me, because I wanted to t- tell the world who are these people.
Yeah, and there's a real touch involved when you are documenting that kind of tragedy, that kind of personal loss, in a way that, you know, I know you don't want anyone to ever feel exploited.
Mm-hmm.
How do you navigate those difficult moments? And then I'm curious to know the personal toll it may take on you. It must be difficult.
Yeah, it's been difficult over the years. I'll be quite honest about that. But that's because if you see a lot of death and destruction, whether it's war and conflict or natural disasters, and because I've been based in Asia for 2 decades, I've covered a lot of earthquakes, floods in Pakistan, et cetera, et cetera. And just covering these horrific events is difficult. You know, witnessing death is not easy. And trying to be sympathetic to the people you photograph and feel like you're making a difference is very important to me whenever I can do it. I mean, when I covered the Rohingya crisis in 2017, I covered it for 2 months. But then at the end of it, I got an assignment from a UK newspaper that I work for frequently, and it was a Christmas appeal. And we, through this Christmas appeal, we were able to raise over £1 million British that went directly to the Rohingya through Save the Children. So it's times like that when I go, wow, I've been able to do something.
You just heard Paula Braunstein. David Carson is a photojournalist who was a 2015 Pulitzer Prize winner in breaking news photography. St. Louis Post, and someone who is not far from Ferguson, Missouri. How quickly did you know how big it was going to be?
In the first 2 days of the protests or after the shooting, this looked to me like every other police shooting I had covered previously. And St. Louis has about 10 to 12 fatal police officer-involved shootings a year. We've had 2 in the last week in St. Louis. So I had covered a number of these fatal police officer-involved shootings in St. Louis over the years, and so I wasn't... This to me looks sort of similar, where there was a community outrage and stuff, but it would typically die down and the police would circle the wagons and not give out a lot of information. But what was taking place that was different here in Ferguson was that there was an entire narrative developing on Twitter and social media about what had taken place, and that was really feeding the community outrage. And that, you know, more people turned out on the streets because they saw what was happening on social media or what was reported to be happening on social media. And that led to just more and more conflicts with the police, and then things began to spiral out of control.
You end up as a Pulitzer Prize winner for some of the work there, but I'm wondering just sort of the toll, you know, maybe on you and the staff, and your sort of the human approach to trying to understand, to try to grapple with just the scale of it. This was one event, but it became a national story. And it became a national story because the maybe strange thing about the Michael Brown case is in some communities, a lot of the details matter, but they don't matter as much as the symbolic nature of what has happened in a lot of different cities. How do you approach it? How do you try to tell that story? And at the time, are you thinking, I'm covering this event in the narrow sense, or this is an event that is touching our entire country, and that's what this story is?
You know, to try to put all that into context is, you know, what we're trying to do on the ground there. And when you're standing in the middle of protesters and there's a line of police and riot gear lined up there and they start firing tear gas. And to try to keep all that in perspective and try to keep the best picture, to keep the big picture of it, I don't know if you're really aware of it while you're doing it as much as you are responding to a rapidly evolving situation and trying to maintain your safety and think about, okay, where do I need to be and where can I not be and stuff. I mean, I used a lot of my hostile environment training from Afghanistan and Iraq and while I was in Ferguson. Like, how am I going to stay safe? I often nights wore a bulletproof vest and a ballistic helmet and had a gas mask on my leg. So, you know, it was interesting, you know, to be employing these personal safety tactics 10 miles from my front door. And, you know, this wasn't happening 1,000 miles away. This was, you know, right out, you know, these were people I knew. I knew some of the police officers. I knew some of the protesters. And my job was to accurately report what was going on there and you know, kind of to create a historical record of this, of these events.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370. WRUR 88.5 FM, and Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. That's WEOS.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we will talk to you Monday.